Hi, my name is Reva Fansalkar, and I'm a research and outreach specialist at the New York State Water Resources Institute. Today, I'm partnering with ESW Cornell's business and outreach team, guest starring this week on State of the Pod, live from Ithaca, New York. In the context of the global climate crisis, indigenous communities occupy a space at the edge of precarity and promise. Indigenous groups worldwide have contributed the least to climate change, but are disproportionately affected by its impacts, which presents a great environmental injustice. Owing to their dependence on natural resources, they are more sensitive to environmental disruptions. At the same time, indigenous groups are also stewards of knowledge that can offer the most effective solutions for adaptation in their communities. Traditional ecological knowledge systems, or TEK, offer alternative ways of responding to climate change. Since these practices emerge from and are deeply rooted in a place's ecology, geography, and climate, they present nuanced, contextually relevant, and technologically advanced approaches to living in harmony with the environment. In the United States, climate change increasingly threatens coastal communities, and its impacts include increased erosion, impacts to water quality and aquatic ecosystems, and an increased risk of flooding due to sea level rise and storm surge. Though governments at various levels are working to respond to these risks, tribal rights to self-determination and their status as independent sovereign nations enable them to take independent climate action that can begin to present an alternative to federal and state approaches. Adaptation efforts informed by TEK include sustainable land and resource management strategies based on the complex, pragmatic understanding of how to sustainably live with the landscape, manage it as a home, and perceive and adapt to changes in it. Coastal tribes and indigenous groups have always been leaders in coastal adaptation because of their exceptional projects and planning initiatives, and it is critical to bring indigenous knowledge to the forefront of climate adaptation planning and policy. Today, we'll dig a little deeper on how some of these themes and tensions manifest in the case of the Shinnecock Indian Nation, which is one of the oldest self-governing tribes in the state of New York. The Shinnecock people have occupied and stewarded their homelands on the eastern end of Long Island from a time long before contact with European settlers. In their language, the Shinnecock name roughly translates into English as people of the stony shore. Our guest for today's podcast is Siobhan F. Smith, who is a member of the Shinnecock Nation and the director of the Shinnecock Environmental Department. Siobhan will tell us about how adaptation and natural resource management efforts at the nation draw on traditional ecological knowledge and the work that they are doing to address negative environmental impacts along the coast of Long Island. So let's jump right in.
Good afternoon. My name is Siobhan Smith. I am a member of the Shinnecock Indian Nation, and I serve as the environmental director. I oversee the environmental department for the tribe. And specifically, we have a natural resource management program. We have aquaculture program. We have a food sovereignty, food sustainability program that comes under that. We do some work with air quality, helping to improve particularly indoor air for tribal members, looking at some of the things that might impact indoor air and outdoor air. We have a water quality monitoring program that we have been developing for a number of years. And we have five sites around Shinnecock that we continuously collect water quality data from. And then we're going to use that to work in conjunction with EPA to really get a baseline of what our water resources look like and how they are well suited for our lifestyle, our needs, the needs of our neighbors and surrounding communities, what some of the issues might be, and then what we can do to try to address those and improve water quality.
Right. That's really nice. And regarding water resources, can you tell us about the biggest water resource and environmental challenges that the Shinnecock Nation is currently facing? And how does climate change intersect with these issues?
Sure. So I think one of the biggest concerns that we have is maintaining water quality that allows us to continue to basically harvest the waters and swim in the water. So right now, the portion of Shinnecock Bay that is by the Shinnecock Nation, we have a very fortunate water quality. So we're not experiencing too many concerns in the area that is directly off of the shoreline, say, like where a lot of the tribal members spend time, you know, swimming. There's a lot of people that still harvest clams. The environmental department has an oyster grow out, so the water quality is very important for all those reasons. One of the concerns, though, is when you move to the eastern side of Shinnecock and in between Shinnecock land and then on the neighboring side, there's the Southampton town. There's a water body that's called Heady Creek, and Heady Creek is seasonally closed to shell fishing and harvesting because of the poor quality. Really, it has to do with like between septic systems and wildlife. And so that is really what's impacting the water quality in that area at this time. And we're really hoping to be able to work with Southampton Town to identify the source and any other concerns that might be bringing down the water quality and trying to work together to come up with a plan so that we can address those issues and really begin to take steps to improve the water, to go ahead and find out what we can do to address that. And the reason why I would say it's also connected to climate change is because as the water temperatures rise, you know, we're going to have more instances of algal blooms. So with the temperature, you really start to see like these dramatic algal blooms. And so that, you know, it impacts the clarity of the water. And then depending on what kind of algae it is, when the oysters and the clams are feeding off of it, it either can create sickness for that living organism and then you'll have die off. Or in some cases, not really so much in this area, but there are other areas where certain algae that the oyster filters and gets into their system then in turn becomes a serious problem for the human that consumes it. And so all those are connected to nutrient loading, everything that's going into the water, and then the rising temperature of the water. And it really is, it fuels it and then just allows those algae populations to just expand and grow.
Yeah, it's interesting to see all the different changes that have happened as a result of climate change and how it's affected, especially with the oysters and the other marine life near the Shinnecock Nation. And it's also been fascinating to learn about approaches to climate adaptation that tribal nations nationwide have been spearheading more broadly in the United States that are rooted in age-old indigenous practices and culture. Regarding that, could you tell us a little more about this concept of traditional ecological knowledge? What is it and what is its role in addressing some of the environmental challenges in your community?
So, for instance, right now, what we're trying to do is really support and enhance the current natural environment, the ecosystem that's there, right? Mm-hmm. So we have been continuously reseeding the area with oysters because they are filter feeders. And so we see that as one way to not only provide a food source for community and potential economic development, but also to help filter the water and improve the water quality. We've been free casting clams. And so, you know, that's another filter feeder. We're constructing the oyster reef. Not only will it help with the wave energy, but it will also create habitat for other species, other fish, crabs, you know, and that's just that in itself is an improvement in the environment. And it'll help just keep feeding the food chain and the food web and improving the environment. And then bringing, you know, more species will begin to come back to the waters that were previous there that maybe at the time, you know, it wasn't a good environment for them because their food source wasn't there. And so it shows how just by improving the situation for one organism just greatly expands, like ripples out.
One thing I was interested in while doing some research with the Shinnecock Nation was, in fact, what you mentioned, the oyster reef. And I was also wondering, while you've started the construction of it, how effective has it been and what have been some challenges in creating this oyster reef?
Sure. So I would say that yes, the oyster reef has been effective in that it created additional habitat. So bringing more species around it, encouraging more oyster growth, oyster retention, natural sporting of oysters, oyster recruitment so that more oysters will be in the water itself. Part of the bigger project that oyster reef was a part of was also to help with reducing some of that wave energy. And to really help to secure the shoreline and kind of prevent the continued loss of sand that we're experiencing. I will say that it has been effective, but it also needs to have some adjustments made to it. And so some of the things we've been talking about is, for the last few years, we've been elongating it. So some of the other discussions we've been having is, do we need to change the directional portion of it? Should we make it higher in elevation? Should we make the base of it wider? So like right now, it's like 3 bags wide. So maybe we need to make it wider to give the wave energy more surface to go over before it hits the shore. And that's the type of discussion that we have with not only like our natural resource manager and then the aquaculture manager, but then our partners. So we have a number of different federal agencies and, you know, nonprofit, non-governmental organizations that we work with on these projects collaboratively. And so we're working with USGS and they're helping us take measurements along the shoreline of where the sand is. And then we're going to try and track it and see where the sand is shifting mostly to, you know, where the greatest loss is occurring. And recognizing that the impact on the shoreline isn't just the wave action of the water, it's actually the wind and the way the wind is blowing and where it's shifting. And recognizing that in addition to the sand on the shore and the oyster reef in the water, you know, how important plants are and the different dune grasses to really help hold the sand in place and help catch the sand as it's moving and blowing. And that's how you get those naturally forming dunes.
Yeah, that's great, especially all the different solutions and the collaborations with USGS. And regarding this shifting of the sand and the movement, I'm sure it interferes with different sorts of culture and history, specifically whether there's burial grounds or different ceremonies. So in addition to these environmental and resource issues, how is climate change affecting the Shinnecock culture and history, such as ceremonies and medicinal practices?
You know, one of the things that I think we collectively are becoming more mindful of, or just thinking about a little more, when we start talking about the different natural plants, the native plants that are already there, the different types of berries, the different wildflowers that grow that are useful to people, the different trees that have different beneficial uses that people have used them for. Well, we start thinking about all these invasive species that begin moving in, the different types of plants, the different types of other, you know, weeds, for lack of better terms, and then the competing of resources. So plants, trees, they're all also living organisms. And so, you know, they need nutrients, they need water, they need light, they need air, they need space. And so they're used to being in this certain area and being able to essentially know what they can get from the soil and the air that's around them. And now you have this new neighbor, if you will, this invasive other plant that's coming in. You know, the invasive species tend to be a little more aggressive and they just grow a little rapidly and they spread. And so it really becomes like an out-competing. And in addition to the invasive species, then you also have the shifting temperature and different seasons will actually, you know, the plants will start moving north and other plants will start coming in from the south and coming up north, and it will change what plants are available. And, you know, particularly like for the tribes up north that have the maple syrup tapping, like there are parts of Long Island where that's still done, but, you know, you mostly hear about that up north. But with the change in the season, then they're also noticing the difference in times when they're actually able to access maple syrup. And so that's just an example of how cultural practices will change for certain people in certain areas. You know, sometimes, you know, like even right now, sometimes you notice we didn't have any snow and it hasn't really been cold. And then you can see like there are some wildflowers are already starting to push through the ground a little bit. Like the daffodils are always the first plants to come up. Well, one of the first plants to come up. And you can already see the little tiny tips of their green stems starting to push through the soil. And here it is just like mid-February. And so I think it's little things like that, that if you're not paying attention to, you'll actually miss. And then before you know it, it just becomes normal when it's really not normal.
Right. And regarding that, especially in Ithaca, a couple days ago on February 15th, it had reached over 60 degrees here, which was very abnormal, especially in this region of upstate New York. And it was record breaking. And while it was sunny and while it was pleasant, we were all slightly concerned on why it's this warm during this time of the year. But yeah, so we want to narrow down and focus more on specific water issues and learn a little bit more on how you're addressing them as well. So I'll hand it off to Khadija, who will ask the next question. So.
Hello. So the climate vulnerability assessment that was released says that ocean acidification will hinder the ability of calcifying organisms such as shellfish to build shells and skeletons. And this is from your climate vulnerability assessment and action plan 9. And I just wanted to know, could you tell us a little bit more about how this affects shellfish in your community and how are local shellfish industries and cultural practices affected by this?
So fortunately, it's not something that we're experiencing yet, but it's what we are being mindful and concerned about what could potentially come about because of ocean acidification. And, you know, one of the things that I thought was the perfect example is the quahog, the hard shell clam, right? So the hard shell clam, if it was no longer able to harden and form and really exist the way that we know it to exist, it would impact food source because there are plenty of people that still go out and harvest clams to eat at home. Some people sell them. So it's a food source. It's potential economic. Then the clam shell itself, once you know, you've removed the meat from it and you've eaten it, that clam shell is also a cultural resource. Because there are plenty of people today that still can take that clamshell and turn it into beads. They can turn it into jewelry. They make earrings from it. A lot of times when kids are young, you take the clamshell and you could put dry beans inside and it becomes like a hand rattle. So it's like a musical instrument that the kids can use during our socials. So this one, what seems like such a small, and you don't think of all the ways that it could be used, it seems insignificant. You're like, oh, it's just a clam. But it's really not just a clam. I just identified like 4 uses for the clam. And I think that it is a perfect example of how something can have multi uses within a certain community's culture and life ways. And so that would be something that would have a big impact on our community if the clam was no longer allowed to develop that hardened shell because of the ocean acidification.
Yeah, I really appreciate that answer. And I like how you specified on different levels how your community will be affected by this. I think that's important to definitely know how something as simple as like a clam can have multiple uses. I guess, Wiley, I'll turn it over to you for the next questions.
Yeah, so going off what Khadija said, it's very evident how important clams and shellfish are to the Shinnecock Nation. So I just have another question on that, which is, are there any steps in particular the Shinnecock's taking or are planning to take to counteract the effects of ocean acidification and different damages to shellfish and clam populations? Could you tell us a bit more about the Shellfish Restoration Project, which, just as a refresher, was the plan to spawn and grow 140 million shellfish in a 4-year period through utilizing nurseries and sanctuaries. So just, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and if it's been successful.
So we would get the spat from Cornell and they would bring it to us and we had the holding tanks and the shell bags and it would set and we would care for it for a period of time and then Cornell would come and then take it out to one of the sanctuary sites. So that was really the extent of our work in that particular project, the larger New York State project. And so I'm really not sure if they're considering it a success or if they reach their target goals. I can talk about the efforts that we have here. So in addition to the continual oyster grow out, so every year we purchase oyster seed and we take care of them. We start them off in Heady Creek when they're like about thumbnail size, and we grow them out there for a while. And then we take them over to Shinnecock Bay and Cuppy's Beach, which is kind of like southwestern side of Shinnecock. And then we have some oysters that we grow in a grow out system in the cages and the bags. And then sometimes we just precast them. That way we're trying to also make sure that there is an established wild population, if you will, and hopefully they'll continue to just naturally spawn and survive out there. And there is evidence that that's what's happening. You can find small clusters of oysters. You can find oysters growing on some of the boulders that were put out there during the large restoration project. So we feel very comfortable with the fact that we've been able to help that along. We're also, as I mentioned before, free casting and planting out hard clams. So we're trying to make sure that the hard clam population maintains a level that is accessible to the tribe to harvest and have clams, but also a population that remains in the water body, in the sand, to continue reproducing and continue growing. So we're working on that. And we've started that last year, and we'll do it again this year. The aquaculture manager, he has been looking at what are some of the different ways that we would have to grow clams if the ocean acidification really got to the point where the clam shells were weakening. You know, then I guess you start looking at going inside and really having the inside hatchery setting where you can control the water conditions and make them optimal. I think that would be something that we would eventually have to consider in the future, not just for spawning, but actually for holding the animal for the duration of its life until it was ready to be harvested.
Yeah, that's great. It's really awesome that you have some plans in place and have some ideas of plans that could happen in the future if the issue with ocean acidification gets worse. So I think that's really great. Moving on to a slightly different topic, we know that increased flooding, erosion, and sea level rise are drastically affecting the shoreline in Long Island. And there's been a very successful shoreline restoration effort led by the Shinnecock Nation. Can you tell us a little more about that? And in particular, if there's been any strategies that are notably more successful?
So going back again to the planted grass on the beach. So the areas where the beach grasses were planted, that has had the most success in holding the sand in place. And when that project was initiated, the tribal members that were hired to work on the project worked side by side with Cornell and like literally hand planted those individual shoots of grass. And the way that that plant has taken and really just propagated, like there's these wonderful beds of beach grass and sand dune in the areas where the plants really were able to, you know, proliferate. And so one of the things that I think we could honestly say we learned is how important it is to have those beach grasses in addition to the sand. So it's not enough just to put the sand on the beach. You have to find a way really to help combat the wind, combat the wave energy and all of that. And so moving forward and having to take a look at where we are right now and get a clear idea of where the sand is shifting and how much it's shifting. And now we can adjust, right? So we can go and say, all right, this is where the oyster reef is now, but we need to make it wider. We need to turn it a little bit. Maybe we'll add some lengths going instead of just parallel to the shore. You know, maybe we'll turn it at a slight angle. So those are all the discussions that we're currently having now based on what we're seeing, the changes that have occurred since we first put that sand down in 2015. So here we are like about 6 years later, and really trying to take an inventory of what it looks like. What I will say, particularly where you were mentioning, you know, the flooding continues to be an issue for some parts of the reservation. Shinnecock territory, we really try to avoid the word reservation. It's our ancestral homelands, and it's where we remain. The location of the cemetery is actually at the shoreline. So when you're going along Cuffy's Beach, you actually will run into the cemetery, and it's kind of like up the hill, you go up and there it is. But during the winter months, December and January, where we had some winter storms, I believe one of them was called Elliot. It was a pretty powerful storm. And the next day we have photos where the water and the, the storm surge had created significant flooding at the cemetery. And on the sides, there are these two tidal ponds. One of them is growing pretty rapidly in size. And the other one is like a clogged system. So the water isn't frequently water in it like there is in the one that's to the west of it. But during this storm event, the water had come up over the top. And you can see where there actually were some of the headstones. The water was up and the headstones were surrounded by water. And so that is a very significant concern for us. And looking at how we're going to prevent that from happening in the future and prevent that from getting worse. And one of the things that also happened during that storm is around the edging of that bluff, there had been sand there and there had been planting that had been done there. But the wind around that event was so strong that it really eroded away a lot of that sand that was there. And so one of the things that will have to be done is the replacement of that sand and the increase in the number of plants that we add to it to kind of help secure it a little more. But yeah, the flooding is something that is only going to continue to get, you know, more obvious and more significant.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. And I'm actually going to hand it back to Khadija to ask the next few questions.
All right. So this is questions regarding the Shinnecock assessment back in 2013 with the EPA. One of the recommended goals was to create a local shoreline change analysis. And I know you're talking about the shoreline and the flooding. And I just want to know, has your nation been able to begin this? And how much information have you gathered about it?
So that is what we have just gotten the opportunity to do. So we were fortunate, we applied for some funding and our proposal was selected. And so that's USGS is our partner. And that's actually currently what they're doing right now, is taking all those aerial snapshots and all those measurements along the shoreline. You know, it's like a combination of survey equipment and GPS coordinates. And that's exactly what we're doing right now.
I love to see that there's progress being made on that. I was really excited once I read that study. I guess also on the same study, has there been any progress with just the general climate change adaptation plan that was made with the EPA? And would you mind telling us more about working with the EPA and what you learned from that experience?
So the Shinnecock Environmental Department is partially funded with grants from EPA. Mm-hmm. And so we still work with them in the climate change and in the water quality and air and solid waste and recycling. And we've had a very good, strong working relationship with them. We're actually getting ready to begin a wetland development project. So what that is we currently do not have a wetland program per se, right? So there is no active monitoring of the wetland. There's no baseline assessment of the wetland. And so that's what we're going to be doing right now. And all of the work that we've been doing really centers around identifying the characteristics of Shinnecock from a scientific perspective, right? And then looking at what we need to do to continue to work to mitigate our climate change vulnerabilities, right? Some of the things, no matter what you do, Mother Nature is always going to do what Mother Nature is going to do. Like, for instance, we have migrating wetlands, right? So Shinnecock is a peninsula and we're battling shoreline erosion. And while we're trying to address our concerns of shoreline erosions, so are the plants that live in the wetlands, right? And so as they lose space in front of them, they're going to continue to move further north and move further inward towards the center of the peninsula. And so it does become another concern because you're on a finite amount of land base and you have to find the balance between maintaining natural habitat, which also provides, you know, the ecosystem services, right? So we need wetlands. We need wetlands, A, because one of the things they do is that they help with storm surge and you need them to help catch that water and kind of like soak up some of that water before it comes all the way inland. So we need the wetlands, but we also have to have places for people, humans, to live and build, right? So it's finding that balance between all of that. So we have to develop in a way that meets the needs of people and meets the needs of the animals and meets the needs of the plants and protects and secures the water resources and everything that inhabits the water, because in turn, we also need that to live because it's a food source and it's a place of healing and spiritual comfort for a number of tribal members. And water is important in a number of different ceremonies. And so all of it is connected and all of it is important and all of it needs to be taken care of and preserved. And so it's a constant balancing act.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually taking ethics in the environment class. And in that class, we talked a lot about the balance of both like society and nature and how it's interconnected. And they talked about how we need to give back and how we take from it. It needs to be a constant cycle, not just taking all the resources. So I like that the wetland projects really focuses on that and focuses on the emphasis of not only how it would benefit the nation, but as well as the animals and plants and the water. We have a couple more questions and I'm going to pass that over to Wiley.
Yeah. So going back to the issue with the receding shoreline and flooding, I'm just wondering, can you tell us about how the National Flood Insurance Program affects flood policy and development trends along the shoreline? And does the Shinnecock currently participate in it? And if so, what is their role?
In general, I know that it was hard to, for some people, not even just on Shinnecock, but like in the area here on Long Island on the East End, it was hard for people to get homeowners insurance because of the flood zone. I think most of Shinnecock is in the flood zone. I'm not even certain. I have this map on my wall in my office. And in fact, my daughter was looking at it the other day and she was looking, she saw where our house was. And she says, well, what do all these colors mean? And I said, well, it was a slosh zone map. And I said, well, that's the storm surge at different strengths of hurricane. So you have your category one, your category two, your three, and your four. And it was all differently colored. And she said, well, here's our, and I was like, oh yeah, no, we don't have to worry. I said, we're pretty much close in the middle here. And what she pointed out to me though, cause I guess I never thought about it. We actually were category two, which if you think about it, is not that far out there. Like a category two hurricane is not completely unheard of, right? And so I was like, oh, yeah. I was like, well, I said, this is saying that this is where the storm surge would come. And she was like, this is where the water, I said, right. I said, but in your head, you're thinking like tsunami. I said, that's not what this is saying. I said, so just, you know, just relax a little bit and don't look at the map anymore. But so, you know, really, I think sometimes, like just personally, I say we get a little lax or take it for granted in our thinking. And like I said, I think of storm surge. I immediately think of the shoreline and I think of the houses that are right there at the shoreline. And now I think about the cemetery because it's so close and it's already experiencing flooding. But the truth of the matter is, I mean, depending on how strong these storms really start to get in the East End of Long Island, and you're talking about impacts of floods coming further inland. And it's just another thing that we all have to start thinking about and, you know, just being mindful of it and thinking of how we are going to prepare and address if the need arises. So that's why I keep maps like that around all my office. You know, we're always looking at things like that.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much. And I'm going to hand it back over to Joey now.
Yeah. And so I know you've mentioned a couple times, especially with funding for the shoreline analysis, it's very wonderful that the USGS is able to become involved with measuring and taking all these different surveys and measurements. And I wanted to ask, can you tell us more about some challenges when it comes to working with the federal, state, and non-tribal local governments on environmental issues?
I think for the most part, you know, I can only speak from our experience, but the agencies that I have worked directly with in terms of our environmental concerns here on Shinnecock have been great working relationships. You know, they're relationships of mutual respect. When we're having conversations, I really feel like they are listening to help and also to learn. The hardest part of trying to address our concerns around climate change really, you know, is sometimes it's the need, the technical advisory need, the technical support, the heavy science background that, you know, sometimes you need those experts that specialize in that field to have conversations with you, to hear your concerns, and then hear your ideas and say, okay, this may work like this, or this is why this won't work. And for the most part, I think that we have been very fortunate with the people that we've been working with, because that's how it's been. You know, they come and they're open-minded, optimistic. They bring their subject matter expertise, but they also recognize that there are specific things that we know about the land. There's specific things that we observe that sometimes you just can't be taught. And so being here and having those discussions and being able to bounce those different ideas around from those various sides, I think, is what has helped our partnerships really work. You know, people say, well, you know, you get to start talking about funding. They're like, well, there's all these grants that are available. Just apply for these grants. It's a lot of work to apply for grants. And, you know, when you're dealing with small staffs, and I mean, like, there was a point in time where the environmental department was me, Viola, and one other person. Like, we were a 3-man show, and it becomes a struggle. So you're in this constant cycle of looking for funding, applying for funding, hoping you're successful for funding, getting the funding, then implementing the work, reporting on the work, and then you're right back at it again. All while you're doing that, you're still looking for funding. Because a lot of times it's like a 1-year grant or it's a 2-year project, and it's like they want a beginning date and an end date, you know? And so, but in order to create longevity in jobs and to maintain a workforce, to train and have them be able to identify these concerns and then help to work towards addressing these concerns, and you have to be able to pay them, and you have to be able to, you know, nobody wants to apply for a job if they're only going to be able to work 6 months and then they got to look for another job. So I think recognizing that sometimes these grant applications are very labor intensive, and not everybody has the time or sometimes even the skills to write for these grant applications. And I just wish that there was a different way that people could receive funding and assistance from the federal agencies, other than, you know, reading through these 70-page RFPs and hoping that you're at least going to get through that part. So then you can get your idea onto paper and then write it in the way that they need it to be written and then submit it and then cross your fingers. And it's competitive, right? Mm-hmm. Especially with tribal funding. You hear the government say a lot of times, well, there's just tribal set aside. And then people think, oh, well, then all the tribes automatically get it. No, it's tribal set aside. And then you still have to compete with all the other tribes for these really small amounts of money to do the work that needs to be done. So I would say that's one of the hard things. Other than that, like I said, when you actually are in the work and the discussions and meeting with the different agencies that come, we've been fortunate to have great working relationships. I just think that it's like with everywhere, it's the money, and how do you create a sustainable project when you're at the mercy of grant funding?
Right. Yeah, that's totally valid. Our sub team as well, we're focusing on our sustainable projects comparing. While we've been looking for funding, it is also, we can relate to the tedious work it requires applying to these different grants and these different fundings for our projects. But like you said, once the grant is actually in place and awarded and began with project work, having these conversations with the partners who are providing the funding, especially with the Shinnecock Nation, what you've explained, they have been very beneficial, especially with all the phenomenal solutions that the Shinnecock has implemented into the shoreline, like the growing grass and the oyster reef shell. And it has all been very beneficial, as you noted. Something I feel that other Indigenous nations can reflect across the nation or can refer to and admire when they're applying for funding and looking for different sources and how to improve their civilization and their surrounding area from these effects, especially coastal Indigenous nations, how they can use and refer to the Shinnecock as a wonderful example of this collaboration. Even people around the U.S., how we can implement these engineering Western science solutions, implement it with the traditional ecological knowledge, and formulate these solutions that have actually been very effective, as you've mentioned.
You know, and that's, I just wanted to say that too. It's another resource is reaching out to lots of different tribal organizations. And so there are different conferences throughout the years, and it's the opportunity for tribes, you know, we get together and learn from each other. And so there are so many tremendous opportunities to network within tribal nations and then with, you know, outside of that. And I think that is, just like you said, I think when we all can just begin to view these common concerns as just that, common concerns, like something that's going to impact all of us. Like water is a shared resource. And so no matter how clean we have it on this side, if it's not as clean on the other side, the waters are all mixing. And so that's why I'm really hopeful to be able to work with the Southampton town to take a look at Hetty Creek and see really what it is that we can do to improve the water quality over there. And it's just about everybody getting to the table and having those discussions and hearing each other out and recognizing that, you know, what I'm using the water for may not be what you're using the water for, but it's important and it's valuable. And we need to make sure that I can use the water just as well as you can use the water. Right. And that all is just going to come by sitting down and talking and just having those real conversations about what's impacting it and what can we do to address it. So I just wanted to add that, and I appreciated everything you were saying. And you know, that's part of the reason why we talk to as many people as we can. So when people ask us if we can talk to them, answer some questions, then I try to just be very open, because I do think it's important to share the work that we do to help others. But also somebody may be listening, or someone may read like a news article that we do or a magazine article that we do, and they see what we've done and say, oh, you know what? I know what might improve that. And then hopefully they'll reach out to us over here at Shinnecock and they'll say, you know, I heard about your project and I was thinking XYZ might improve that oyster reef, you know? So I think that it's important to talk. And so whenever we get the opportunity to do that, we look forward to it. And I'm not a professional speaker, but I hope I can get the message across well enough that it makes sense to people. So thank you for
that. Yeah, absolutely. ESW as a whole, we really appreciate your input and response on our questions and are able to communicate all this information for this podcast. And it's been a wonderful time personally to hear your experience from the Shinnecock Nation.
Yeah, just building off what Joey said, thank you so much for meeting with us today. I think we all learned a lot about the Shinnecock Nation, and super impressive all the work that has been happening on Long Island. And again, like Joey said earlier, it's definitely best to lead by example. And it seems like for other nations across the United States, the Shinnecock is doing an amazing job setting a great example in terms of how you're counteracting climate change. And a lot of the projects that you're working on are just super inspiring. So again, thank you so much for meeting with us. It was great to hear so much about the Shinnecock Nation and your work in particular.
Yeah, same as Joey and Wiley, I'm very thankful that you set some time aside to talk to us about these issues and some of the progress you've made, especially compared to the 2013 study. A lot of progress you made with the clams and the oysters and just increasing the shellfish in your area. And I am excited to learn more about what other projects you're going to be embarking, such as the wetlands project.
Well, thank you so much, guys. And I enjoyed the conversation. And thank you for reaching out to us. And thank you for being interested in what we do.
This podcast was conceptualized by a group of students at Engineers for a Sustainable World, or ESW for short. ESW is an engineering project team committed to forging innovative, lasting solutions for local and global sustainability challenges. Since its establishment in 2002 at Cornell, ESW has expanded to become an international nonprofit network with over 50 chapters and more than 4,000 members. The New York State Water Resources Institute, or WRI for short, provided guidance and support to ESW in doing this work. At WRI, we address critical water resource issues in New York State and beyond through research and outreach projects that we do in partnership with state agencies and Cornell University. I'm Reva. I'm a research and outreach specialist at WRI, and I work to support community-engaged climate adaptation planning, specifically focused on flood resilience. Four ESW members were involved in this project. Wiley Gifford is a junior studying environment and sustainability and the current team lead of the ESW business and outreach team. Joey Armstrong is a sophomore studying chemical engineering and the current treasurer. Kadijat Alakio is a junior in environmental engineering and the current vice president of Engineers for a Sustainable World.